This is the Everything Financial Radio Program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. I am here every week at this time. This is where we talk about what's going on in the economy and what it might mean for your money. We also interview a guest expert each week, and joining me on today's program, I'm delighted to have Mr. Peter J. Wallison joining me just momentarily. Mr. Wallison was general counsel of the U.S. Treasury back from 1981 to 1985, and from 1986 through 1987, Mr. Wallison was White House counsel to President Ronald Reagan. We'll be getting his take on what's going on as far as the banking system, and are we going to see another banking collapse? We're going to base the conversation on his book, Hidden in Plain Sight. And as I said, he'll be joining me in just about a minute and a half. Also on today's program, I'll be considering a question, are we Rome? Many of you probably recall when Mr. Lawrence Reed, who's president of the Foundation of Economic Education, joined me on the program. We visited this topic briefly, but today I'm going to be talking about an article that Mr. Reed wrote that compares current U.S. monetary policy and social policy with that of Rome. And he asked the question, is our social policy going to lead to our demise as it did in Rome? Quick reminder, we do have another new retirement rules class coming up. It will be held on February 21. That's a Saturday. It will begin at 9 a.m. and conclude at 2:30 p.m. The cost for the class is just $49. That includes the book that you'll get when you register for the class. It'll also include all the class handouts and lunch for you and a guest. You can get more information by visiting the website newretirementrules.com. You can also register there while capacity remains. And again, the date for the class is Saturday, February 21. It will be held at the downtown campus of Western Michigan University. And during the class, we talk about current monetary policy. We talk about where we are in our current economic cycles and what will it mean for maybe your 401k investments. And we give you some actual strategies you can use in the class as well. When you leave the class, you'll have a very nice resource, we believe, that you can use to help manage your personal finance. So again, the website is newretirementrules.com, and you can get more information there and register while capacity remains. I am pleased to have as a first-time guest here on the Everything Financial Radio program, Mr. Peter J. Wallison. He is the author of the book Hidden in Plain Sight, What Really Caused the World's Worst Financial Crisis and Why It Could Happen Again. Mr. Wallison is an attorney. He is also a Arthur F. Burns Fellow in Financial Policy Studies at the American Enterprise Institute. He has been had worked in the government also. He's been a lead counsel for the U.S. Department of Treasury as well as counsel in the Reagan administration. And welcome to the program, Mr. Wallison.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Well, I think the listeners would love to hear a bit about your work with not only the Reagan administration, but the Department of Treasury. Tell us a little bit about what you did.
Well, the General Counsel of the Treasury is the chief legal officer at the Treasury Department. And when I was there, which was the early part of the Reagan administration between 1981 and 1985, the really key questions that we were dealing with was what we called financial deregulation, because as you may recall, in the 1970s, there was a lot of deregulation that occurred in all kinds of areas of the economy. We deregulated the securities market. We deregulated transportation. We deregulated air travel. We deregulated communications. All of those things were to the good because there was they produced a lot of competition, lower prices, a lot of innovation. So all of that was going on. We came into office and we saw that the one area that had never been deregulated in any substantial way was finance. We were still strictly controlling the banks and what they could do, and we felt that that was creating a lot of many restrictions and limitations in our economy that kept the financial business from being adequately competitive. Unfortunately, there is a lot of objection to deregulating finance. That means that banks and others would be able to compete with other non-bank organizations. And so there was a lot of fighting back. And we were never able, well, the time I was at the Treasury Department or when I was in the White House, to actually reduce the regulation of the financial area. But still, it is something worth doing, and we have seen now what happens when the government is in control of a financial area. It causes serious problems, and that's what my book is about.
Well, let's talk about the book, and if you're just joining us, we're chatting with Peter J. Wallison, who's the author of Hidden in Plain Sight, What Really Caused the World's Worst Financial Crisis and Why It Could Happen Again. Peter, for our listeners that may not be familiar with exactly what caused the financial crisis, and I know there's some debate about that, give us your view on just a very fundamental 101 level as to what caused the financial crisis of 2008.
What the American people have heard is one story about what caused the financial crisis, and that is that it was caused by risk-taking and greed on Wall Street. This is what the Obama administration has said from the beginning. This is what Obama actually said in the first debates with John McCain in 2008 when he was first running. And when he came into office with supermajorities on the Democratic side in Congress, they were successful in getting that narrative accepted by the press, and it became the basis for the so-called Dodd-Frank Act, which imposes yet more regulation on the financial industry. That's the story, that it is the banks that caused the financial crisis, is the way most people in the United States today look at the issue. But my book shows, I think, with substantial data, that it was in fact the government's housing policy that created the financial crisis. And I'll try to explain that very simply, and that is the government instituted policies in 1992 which caused underwriting standards for mortgages to decline substantially, so that by 2008, just before the financial crisis, a majority of the mortgages in the United States were subprime mortgages. That is, they were very weak mortgages, ready to default as soon as the economy turned down. Of that majority, and that means of the 55 million mortgages in the United States in early 2008, 31 million were subprime mortgages. And of those 31 million, 76% were on the books of government agencies. And that shows you where the demand for those mortgages came from.
76% really government-backed, directly or indirectly, is just a staggering statistic. What would you say, Peter, to those who say that it was the Fed's interest rate policy that was really the cause of the financial crisis? It allowed private sector debt levels get to unsustainable levels, and that's really the cause of the crisis.
Well, I just don't see any data for that. I mean, it's clear that the Fed reduced their interest rates starting in late 2002 and early 2003. But by that time, by early 2003, we already had a bubble in housing in the United States that was three times the size of any housing bubble we had ever had before. Now, that means to me that the Fed's monetary policy was not important in creating the housing bubble. It was something else. And to me, that something else, and this is made very clear in the book, that something else was a government housing policy that reduced underwriting standards for mortgages. And I'll explain how that could happen. Let's assume that you have, say, $20,000 that you saved up to buy a house. Now, if the down payment for a house is 10%, that means you can buy a $200,000 house. But if the underwriting standards are reduced, as the government forced them to be, so that you can then buy a house with 5% down, that means you can buy a $400,000 house. Now, that is exactly how a bubble would develop, because there was more money bidding for more homes and more expensive homes. And that's what drove the great housing bubble that actually ended up by 2008 being about nine times the size of any previous bubble. But It was already well on its way to nine times by 2003, when the Fed did most of the interest rate reductions. So I don't see any substantial link between the housing bubble and the Fed's policies, although I know that economists love to make that claim. I just don't see it. It's not in the data to me.
Well, our guest today is Mr. Peter J. Wallison. His book is Hidden in Plain Sight, What Really Caused the World's Worst Financial Crisis and Why It Could Happen Again. I'll continue my conversation with Mr. Wallison when Everything Financial Radio returns after these words. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. I will continue my conversation with Mr. Peter J. Wallison in the next segment. You know, on this program, we talk often about economic cycles and the fact that economic cycles, when one studies history, repeat themselves. In fact, you probably remember your history professor saying at one point, those who don't study history are doomed to repeat it. That said, there was an article published by Mr. Lawrence Reed, and Mr. Reed has been a guest here on the program. Mr. Reed is president of the Foundation for Economic Education, which is a free enterprise research institute. He looked at the Roman Empire and wrote a piece that talked about the parallels between the United States today and the Roman Empire of more than 2,000 years ago, actually as much as 2,500 years ago. And on today's program, I want to share with you a bit from that article. Monumental sums for bailouts, staggering increases in public debt, concentration of power in the central government, a mad scramble by interest groups with endless claims on the Treasury, mushrooming regulations on enterprise, demagogue class warfare appeals, higher taxes on the productive, decline of virtues once widely embraced as essential for strong character. These things ring familiar in 21st century America just as surely as they dominated the ill-fated Roman welfare state two millennia ago. Both Rome and America were born in revolt against monarchy. Wary of concentrated authority, both established republics with checks and balances, separation of powers, and protection of certain rights of at least certain people, if not all. The history of ancient Roman Empire spans 1,000 years, roughly 500 as a republic and 500 as an imperial autocracy. The birth of Christ occurred during the transitional years in between. Thomas Madden, the historian, demonstrated in his book, Empires of Trust, the closest parallels between Roman and American civilizations are to be found in Rome's first half millennium as a republic. So Rome and America initially had the same types of governments, essentially. The paramount lesson of the Roman experience, Mr. Reed writes, is actually not peculiar to Rome. It may be, in fact, the most universal lesson of all history. No people who have lost their character have kept their liberties. Roman society at the time of the Republic's founding was basically agricultural, made up of small farmers and shepherds. By the 2nd century BC, large-scale businesses made their appearance. Italy became urbanized. Immigration accelerated as people from many lands were attracted by the vibrant growth and opportunities of the bustling Roman economy. The growing prosperity was made possible by a general climate of free enterprise, limited government, and respect for private property. Merchants and businessmen were admired and emulated. No one should claim that Romans fostered a libertarian society. They took liberty to new heights in many ways by limiting the power of the state, but shortcomings were plentiful. This much is clear. The liberties they achieved were made possible and sustained for centuries by traits of character on which liberty always depends: courage, hard work, personal independence, and self-reliance. Rome's remarkable achievements in sanitation, education, banking, architecture, and commerce are legendary. The city even had a stock market. With low taxes and tariffs, free trade, and considerable private property, Rome became the center of the world's wealth. All this disappeared, however, by the 5th century AD, and when it was gone, the world was plunged into darkness and despair, slavery, and poverty. Why did Rome decline and fall? Rome collapsed because of a fundamental change in ideas on the part of the Roman people. Ideas which relate primarily to personal responsibility and the source of personal income. In the early days of greatness, Romans regarded themselves as their chief source of income. What does that mean? It means an individual looked to himself, what he could acquire in the marketplace as a source of his livelihood. Rome's decline began when the people discovered another source of income, the political process, the state. In short, it was a character issue. Rome rose to greatness on the pillars of strong personal character. It foundered when its people sacrificed character for less noble things like power and the false temporary security of a handout. When Romans abandoned self-responsibility and self-reliance and began to vote themselves benefits to use government to rob Peter to pay Paul, to put their hands into other people's pockets, to envy and covet the productive and their wealth, they turned down a fateful and destructive path. As the late Dr. Howard E. Kirshner put it, when a self-governing people confer upon their government the power to take from some and give to others, the process will not stop until the last bone of the last taxpayer is picked bare. The legalized plunder of the Roman welfare state was undoubtedly sanctioned by people who wished to do good. But as Henry David Thoreau wrote, if I knew for certain that a man was coming to my house to do me good, I would run for my life. Another person coined the phrase, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Nothing but evil can come from a society bent on coercion, the confiscation of property, and the degradation of the productive. In the waning years of the Roman Republic, a rogue named Clodius ran for the office of tribune. He bribed the electorate with promises of free grain at taxpayer expense and won the election. Thereafter, Romans in growing numbers embraced the notion that voting for a living could be more lucrative than working for one. Candidates for Roman office spent huge sums to win public favor, then plundered the population afterwards to make good on their promises to the rent seekers who elected them. As the Republic gave way to dictatorship, a succession of emperors built their power on the huge handouts they controlled. Nearly a third of the city of Rome itself received public relief payments by the time of the birth of Christ. The historian H.J. Haskell describes this tragic turn of ideas and events. Less than a century after the Republic had faded into the autocracy of the empire, the people had lost all taste for democratic institutions. On the death of an emperor, the Senate debated the question of restoring the Republic, but the commons preferred the rule of an extravagant leader who would continue the dole and furnish them free shows. The mob outside clamored for one ruler of the world. It's frightening to consider how easily a sturdy people, when they let their guard and character down, can be bought and paid for by the welfare state. And once they sell themselves for that mess of pottage from politicians, it's simply not easy to turn back. Speaking of the Emperor Augustus, who ruled from 27 BC to 14 AD, and who tried to reduce the free wheat program by briefly introducing a means test, Haskell cites the emperor's biographer and contemporary. He, referring to Augustus, was inclined to abolish forever the public distribution of grain, for the people had come to rely on it and had ceased to till the fields. But he had not proceeded further in the matter because he was sure that, from a desire to please the people, it would be revived at one time or another. In response to a severe money and credit crisis in 33 AD, the central government extended credit at zero interest on a massive scale. Sound familiar? And government spending in the wake of the crisis soared. I'm going to pick this up in the fourth segment of today's program. We study economic cycles and make an economic forecast based on our research. And if you look ahead as to where we might be headed economically speaking and examine what the consequences might be for your nest egg, we believe that there is potentially some threats on the horizon. We outline these threats and what you might do to combat them and not only protect yourself but potentially profit as well. In our new retirement rules class, we've got a class coming up on the 21st of February. You can get more information by visiting newretirementrules.com, or you can sign up there while we have capacity yet in the class. Again, the website, newretirementrules.com. I'll be back after these words.
Give me-
Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. I have the distinct pleasure of chatting today with Mr. Peter J. Wallison. He is the author of the book, Hidden in Plain Sight, What Really Caused the World's Worst Financial Crisis and Why It Could Happen Again. Let me jump back in again, Peter, because I think our listeners may be a bit shocked, although maybe not surprised, by something you said in the last segment, and that is that the government forced that underwriting standards for mortgages be lowered. So essentially it allowed maybe folks that wouldn't have qualified for a mortgage under old rules to now go out and borrow money. And you said the government forced this. So explain that a little bit. Are you saying that the government actually told banks you have to loan money to these people even though you wouldn't ordinarily loan money to them?
No, actually they didn't. It was a little more subtle than that. And it was probably simply a failed policy. It's the kind of policy that government adopts without thinking through what the consequences would be. And we see that all the time. And this was just one area where it became a disaster. But what happened in 1992 was this. The government had been backing two very large companies that were engaged in the mortgage market called Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And up to 1992, Fannie and Freddie, as they were called, were only buying prime mortgages. They would never buy a subprime mortgage. And then many people complained, well, because you won't buy these subprime mortgages, a lot of low-income people cannot buy homes because they can't get mortgages. They don't have good credit, and they don't have the down payments and so forth. So what we are going to insist on now, says Congress, is we want you, whenever you buy mortgages from banks or from other originators, 30% of those mortgages have to be made to people who are at or below the median income where they live. Okay, that probably wasn't too tough to do, but then the power to increase that quota was given to the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And what they did was over time they increased the amount that the quota that Fannie and Freddie had to meet. So by 2000, it was 50%, and by 2008, it was 56%. So more than half of all mortgages that they bought had to be made to people who are at or below the median income. Now, when you think about it, it's very hard to find prime mortgages for people who are below the median income for obvious reasons. Sometimes they have problems with divorce and health and job retention and things like that, and so they're not always good credits. And if you're told you have to buy these mortgages, then you're going to have to, in order to get them, you're going to have to reduce your underwriting standards. And that's what they did. So that by the middle of the 1990s, they were accepting mortgages with 3% down payments, and by the year 2000, they were accepting mortgages with no down payment. That's how, by 2008, we ended up with most of the mortgages in the United States being subprime. And of those, as I said before, 76% were on the books of government agencies, principally Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
Well, it's amazing, Peter, when you look at government policy, how many times there have been unintended consequences. We could look at the Model City program. The list goes on and on. But let's look at what's happened recently, because in response to the financial crisis, Washington passed something called the Dodd-Frank Act. So let's start by talking about what the Dodd-Frank Act was supposed to do.
Well, Dodd-Frank Act is probably the most restrictive and repressive regulatory legislation since the New Deal. It was supposed to impose many, many restrictions on Wall Street. The actual name of it is Dodd-Frank Consumer Protection and Wall Street Reform Act. And the purpose of the act was to impose many, many more restrictions on Wall Street and on large financial firms generally. And you've maybe heard of particular parts of the act, the Volcker Rule and other things, increases in the capital that banks have to hold and so forth. And all of those things were intended to reduce the likelihood or the possibility that the banking industry or financial industry in general would take risks. Now, our economy works when, and only works, at least in terms of economic growth, when financial institutions will take risks. And what The Dodd-Frank Act has done basically is clamp down on risk-taking all through the financial industry. And as a result, since it was put into place in 2010, we've had the slowest recovery from a recession. That was right after the financial crisis. We have the slowest recovery from a recession that we've had since the mid-1960s. And it's probably going to continue into the future. It's a very slow recovery. It'll be hard to bring back the kind of growth levels, 4%, 5%, that we had before the Dodd-Frank Act was put into effect.
So, Peter, and if you're just joining us, listeners, we're chatting today with Mr. Peter J. Wallison, author of Hidden in Plain Sight, What Really Caused the World's Worst Financial Crisis and Why It Could Happen Again. So, Peter, let's just look ahead. What will be some of the unintended consequences, if that's a fair question, of the Dodd-Frank Act? You mentioned slower economic growth than we would otherwise have. Are there any other unintended consequences that you see?
Well, that's a pretty big unintended consequence, because that affects every person in the United States. We saw the president last night talking about a middle-class policy. Well, you know, one of the reasons that there has been so little increase, in fact, during the past 6 years of the Obama administration, actual decrease in middle class income, is because of the fact that we haven't had the kind of growth in the economy that would ordinarily have restarted the growth in incomes. So, when you talk about unintended consequences, that's certainly the major one. There are many, many others throughout the act, but I'll mention one that is kind of technical but still very important, something called the Volcker Rule. Now, the Volcker Rule says that banks cannot trade securities for their own account. Not only banks, but affiliates of banks, that is, other firms that are part of a bank holding company. Neither they nor banks can trade for their own accounts. Now, what does that really mean? What it means for people who are in the financial industry is a lot of additional costs, because banks did what is not necessary in the equity markets, because the equity markets are very deep and liquid. So if you want to sell a share of stock, you just go to your broker, and the broker can go right in, and there's a price already in the market for that share of stock. But if you are a pension fund or an insurance company or some other institution that is holding a bond, there isn't a market out there for bonds. What there is are things like banks that agree to make markets. They will buy the bond, and they will hold it, and then they will resell it to someone who wants to buy that bond. That's the only way the market will work. And yet, if you take banks out, as that law, the Volcker Rule does, take banks out of the business of buying and selling for their own accounts, what you do is you make it much harder for people who want to buy bonds to find a place where they can buy the bond. This is after it's been issued by the company, or to sell it if they want to turn it into cash, because there aren't as many buyers in the market. And the effect that that has is to raise what are called spreads between the buy and the sell prices, and that makes it much more expensive to buy a bond and much more expensive to sell it.
Peter, the subtitle of your book, What Really Caused the World's Worst Financial Crisis and Why It Could Happen Again, has a bit of an ominous tone to it. So let me ask you, what is the likelihood, in your opinion, of a repeat of 2008?
If we keep the government still in charge of the housing finance system, I think the chances are 100%. We're going to have the same problem again, because it is in the interest of the government to reduce underwriting standards. It has no interest in maintaining sound underwriting standards, because that does limit the number of people who can buy homes. And if people are able to buy homes very easily, then you get much more growth in the economy. That's one of the ways they're compensating for what they did with the Dodd-Frank Act with excessive regulation. They are now trying to goose, if you will, the economy to increase the number of homes that are bought and sold. The effect over time is going to be exactly the same, and that is there will be much more money pouring into the housing business. It will cause a bubble. The bubble will grow over time. The government will continue to push a lower and lower underwriting standards, much to the enjoyment and pleasure of the realtors and the home builders and people who are advocates for low-income groups. And over time, and I can't say how long it will take, but over time we will have the same kind of bubble again. Then, for some reason, there will be an end to that bubble's growth. It will crash, and a lot of financial institutions and homeowners will suffer huge losses, and we'll have another thing that looks a lot like the financial crisis in 2008.
Well, Peter, we have just a couple minutes left, and I'm going to ask you a question that is maybe a bit out there, but you know, from my experience, whenever the government gets involved in something or a new bureaucracy is created, it's really difficult to get the government back out of it. So how realistic is it to get the government back out of the housing business?
Well, you know, you're right. This is very, very difficult. And the House of Representatives, the House Financial Services Committee, the committee that has jurisdiction in this area, did pass a bill last year, got it out into the House for consideration, that would have taken the government out of that business. But it was not passed in the House. And it's very unlikely that the Senate committee is going to take up a similar bill. So it will be very tough to do. But I wrote the book because until the American people understand what really happened in the financial crisis, understand that it wasn't a problem of the banks taking too many risks, but the government's housing policies, until they understand it, there's not a chance in the world that we will ever get a better housing policy. So it's important that people read the book, understand what happened, and then talk to their representatives.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Mr. Peter J. Wallison, author of Hidden in Plain Sight, What Really Caused the World's Worst Financial Crisis and Why It Could Happen Again. I'd encourage you to pick it up and check it out. And Peter, thank you for joining us. We'd love to have you back.
Thanks very much, Dennis. Have a good day.
Thank you. You too. Everything Financial Radio returns after these words. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen, and I want to take a minute and just say a special thank you to our very special guest today, Mr. Peter Wallison, and we appreciate his time. In the second segment of today's program, I started to talk about the parallels between the Roman Empire of 2,500 years ago and the United States today. I quoted from an article written by Lawrence Reed, who is the president of the Foundation for Economic Education. He's been a past guest here on the program. In fact, if you go to fee.org, you can find the article. It's titled, Are We Rome? In the second segment, I talked about the fact that candidates for office in the Roman Republic spent a lot of money to win public favor. In fact, one of the first giveaway programs, if you will, that really caught on was the free wheat program. I'll go back to the article momentarily. The article says, it's frightening to consider how easily a sturdy people, when they let their guard and character down, can be bought and paid for by the welfare state. And once they sell themselves for that mess of pottage from the politicians, it's not easy to turn back. Speaking of the Emperor Augustus, who ruled from 27 BC to 14 AD, and who tried to reduce the free wheat program by briefly introducing a means test, the biographer that wrote about this quoted, he was inclined to abolish forever the public distribution of grain, for the people had come to rely upon it and had ceased to till the fields. They got the free grain, so why till the fields? But Augustus figured that a future politician would simply revive the program in an effort to please the people. Then, quite a while after the free wheat program was introduced, in response to a severe money and credit crisis in 33 AD, the central government extended credit at zero interest and on a massive scale. Government spending in the wake of the crisis soared. Does that sound familiar? Does that sound like something that may have happened here after the recent financial crisis? Going back to Rome, in 91 AD, the government became deeply involved in agriculture. The Roman emperor, to reduce production and raise the price of wine, ordered the destruction of half of the provincial vineyards. Following the lead of Rome, many cities within the empire spent themselves deeply into debt. Think today about all the municipal bankruptcies that we're seeing over the last 7 or 8 years. Beginning early in the second century, municipalities in financial difficulty received aid from Rome and lost a substantial measure of their political independence in the bargain. The government also assumed the responsibility of providing the people with entertainment. Elaborate circuses and gladiator duels were staged to keep the people happy. One modern historian estimates that Rome poured the equivalent of $100 million per year into the games. Under Emperor Antoninus Pius, who ruled from 138 to 161 AD, the Roman bureaucracy reached mammoth proportions. Eventually, according to the historian Albert Trevor, the relentless system of taxation, requisition, and compulsory labor was administered by an army of military bureaucrats. Everywhere were the personal agents of the emperors employed to crush tax evaders. And there were plenty of taxes to evade. Emperor Nero is said by a Roman historian to have once rubbed his hands together and declared, "Let us tax and tax again. Let us see to it that no one owns anything." Taxation ultimately destroyed the wealthy first, followed by the middle and lower classes. What the soldiers or the barbarians spared, the emperors took in taxes, according to the historian W.G. Hardy. Late in the third century, Emperor Aurelian declared government relief payments to be a hereditary right. He provided recipients government-baked bread instead of the old practice of giving them wheat and letting them make their own bread. This emperor said, "We'll make it even easier. We'll just give you the bread." He also added free salt, pork, and olive oil. Rome suffered from the bane of all welfare states, inflation. The massive demands on the government to spend and subsidize created pressures for the multiplication of money. Roman coinage was debased by one emperor after another to pay for expensive programs. Once almost pure silver, the denarius, which was the Roman currency, by the year 300 was a little more than a piece of junk containing less than 5% silver. Does that money printing sound familiar? As a result of the money printing in Rome, prices skyrocketed and savings vanished. Businessmen were vilified even as government continued its spendthrift ways. Price controls further ravaged a battered and shrinking private economy, and by 476 AD, when barbarians wiped the empire from the map, Rome had committed moral and economic suicide. Romans first lost their character, according to Mr. Reed in the article, then as a consequence, they lost their liberties and ultimately their civilization. Mr. Reed closed his article with an old story whose relevance to the Roman Empire will be clear. It's about a band of wild hogs which lived along a river in a secluded area of Georgia. These hogs were a stubborn, ornery, and independent bunch. They had survived foods, fires, freezes, droughts, hunters, dogs, and everything else. No one thought they could ever be captured. One day a stranger came into town not far from where the hogs lived and went into the general store. He asked the storekeeper, "Where can I find the hogs? I want to capture them." The storekeeper laughed at such a claim but pointed in the general direction. The stranger left with his one-horse wagon, an axe, and a few sacks of corn. 2 months later he returned, went back to the store, and asked for help to bring the hogs out. He said he had them all penned up in the woods. People were amazed and came from miles around to hear him tell the story of how he did it. "The first thing I did," the stranger said, "was to clear a small area of the woods with my axe. Then I put some corn in the center of the clearing. At first, none of the hogs would take the corn. Then, after a few days, some of the young ones would come out, snatch some corn, and then scamper back into the underbrush. Then the older ones began taking the corn, probably figuring that if they didn't get it, some of the other ones would. Soon they were all eating the corn. They stopped grubbing for roots and acorns on their own. About that time," the stranger continued, "I started building a fence around the clearing, a little higher each day. At the right moment, I built a trap door and sprung it. Naturally, they squealed and hollered when they knew I had them, but I can pen any animal on the face of the earth if I can corrupt them enough to depend on me for a free handout." Interesting article by Mr. Reed, and I want to close this segment by just giving you some statistics about the current state of the U.S. welfare system and compare it to that of the Roman Empire. There was an article published recently. The title says, National Moral Disgrace, Over 1 in 5 U.S. Children on Food Stamps and Living in Poverty. Over 20% of U.S. children, an estimated 16 million youths, are on food stamps, according to the latest government figures. That number has almost doubled since the Great Recession began in 2007. Nearly a quarter are living below the poverty line. More than 1 in 5 of the country's 73.7 million children now receive Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program benefits, better known as food stamps, the U.S. Census Bureau announced Wednesday in its annual Families and Living Arrangements table package. Before the economic downturn in December of 2007, only 1 in 8 kids, or 9 million, were on food stamps. The U.S. child poverty rate, the percent of children living in households with incomes below 50% of the national median income, is 23.1%. Only Romania is higher at 23.6%, according to a 2013 UNICEF report. There are 14.7 million poor children, of which 6.5 million are considered extremely poor. That's in the United States, according to a report by the Children's Defense Fund. The 14.7 million poor children, those living below the official poverty line of $23,834 for a family of four, exceed the populations of 12 U.S. states combined: Alaska, Hawaii, Idaho, Maine, Montana, New Hampshire, North Dakota, Rhode Island, South Dakota, Vermont, West Virginia, and Wyoming. The figure is also greater than the combined populations of Sweden and Costa Rica, the report found. And when you look at government benefits being paid to households, whether it is a check from Social Security, which admittedly folks have paid into and deserve a benefit, Medicare, but right now that number is 49.2% of all Americans receive benefits from one or more government programs. Interesting analogy. Thought I would share it with you on today's program. Let me remind you that we do have a new retirement rules class coming up on February the 21st. It will be held at the downtown campus of Western Michigan University, downtown Grand Rapids. The cost for the class is just $49. That covers the cost for you and a guest. That covers the book, all the handouts for the class, as well as lunch, which will be served. The class goes from 9 a.m. to 2:30 p.m., and again, you can get more information on the website, newretirementrules.com. Quick reminder, if you'd like to listen to any of our interviews with our guest experts or listen to the program at your convenience, you can simply go to the iTunes store and search under Everything Financial Radio. We produce 2 podcasts per week. The podcasts are free. Again, just go to the iTunes store and search under Everything Financial Radio. That's our program for this week. Talk to you again next week. Bye.